And that's what happens when you're on a really good team. Those guys, they stay together. They're in touch all the time. They're coming back to see you.
On today's episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast, we're joined with Coach Fran Dunphy, the former LaSalle head coach and one of the all-time winningest coaches in Philadelphia history. Coach Fran Dunphy has spent over 30 years on the sidelines leading two of Philadelphia's most prestigious programs, the University of Pennsylvania and Temple University. During his 17 seasons at Penn, he guided the Quakers to 10 Ivy League championships and numerous NCAA tournament appearances, establishing a standard of excellence within the conference. In 2006, he became the head coach at Temple University, where he continued his success with 8 NCAA tournament berths and multiple Atlantic 10 titles over a 13-year span. With a remarkable 580 career wins, Coach Dunphy is widely respected not only for his coaching acumen, but also for his leadership, humility, and unwavering commitment to student athletes. In this episode, we dive into how starting his career coaching at Army had helped his career, how to help your assistants and players grow to be head coaches someday, and how to get the most out of your players and assistants as a head coach. Please welcome to the podcast, Coach Fran Dunphy.
We say it on here all the time. You can't expect your players to get better during the offseason and you don't grow as a coach. That being said, if you are looking to refresh your playbook and get better at practice planning this offseason, check out Dr. Dish Basketball's Coach's Corner to download over 150 free pages of shooting drills, plays, practice resources, team activities, and worksheets, and more, all designed to help you be more prepared going into the next season. Just visit info.drdishbasketball.com and start downloading now. What's up, coaches? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast. We are here. Alan and Doug are back. Today, we are joined with the former LaSalle head coach, Fran Dunphy, one of the legends. Coach Dunphy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it. Good to be with you and Alan. Alan and I go back pretty far, anxious to do this, and hopefully it does somebody some good somewhere.
No, it definitely will, for sure. Yeah, we appreciate it, Coach. This will be fun.
So one of, I know Al said before we hopped on here, but we had one of your former players on, Khalif Wyatt, and we talked about him playing for you, and then Al was, wait a minute, I know that guy. I've been around him for a while now. But then Khalif started talking about everything, and we're like, we got to get Coach Dunphy on. We got to make sure to hear his story. So we're actually really excited to be able to get you on here. I know, especially with you, one of the greatest coaches in Ivy League school history, just to say the least. And, I mean, with your background, there's a lot of things that we want to go over, especially that could resonate with young coaches. But, of course, like, one thing that we always like to learn is just a little bit about how it started. So, like, what ultimately segued you into this industry, as well as were there any mentors that kind of helped guide you there? Because as there always are.
Yeah, I think the mentoring is so critical in all of this. There's that famous statement that none of us gets to where we are by ourselves, and somebody has to have helped us and showed us the way. And probably the guy that was most instrumental in my life, certainly in the early years, was my high school basketball coach. His name was Dan Dougherty. He left us a couple of years ago. And he was my high school coach. And then after I got out of high school and went to LaSalle as a player, he became an assistant coach at Villanova for the next 4 years, 5 years. And they had a good run in 1971. They were in the NCAA tournament, played Houston. I forget who they played in the Final Four. And he got the job at West Point after Bobby Knight left. So he was the coach at West Point between Bobby Knight and Mike Krzyzewski. And the interesting part of that is I was in the Army. After I got out of LaSalle, I got drafted in the Army, and I was just about ready to go to either Vietnam or Germany as an 81-millimeter mortar shooter. And so it was an amazing time. And right before I got my orders, this captain of my company came down and said, "You have a phone call in my office." And I got on the call, and it was a guy by the name of Hal Fisher, who was the coach of the All-Army basketball team. He said, "Would you like to try out?" I'm at Fort Ord, California. I said, "Sure, yeah, I'd love to." I jump on a bus the next day to go from Fort Ord to Presidio of San Francisco. I get there, and the first guy I meet when I get off the bus is Mike Krzyzewski, who's already on the team. I shoot jumpers for 3 days. I guess I make most of them, so I make the team. We travel around the United States. We travel to Frankfurt, Germany, Athens, Greece, Beirut, Lebanon, and finally to Damascus, Syria. I go on that tour, and as I go, they take me out of being a mortar man and make me a personnel clerk. And right before I'm supposed to report for personnel clerking, I get a call from Dan Dougherty to ask if I wanted to be the enlisted assistant at West Point for the season 71-72. And so I'm an assistant coach that year for the full 6 month period of time from October to April. Then I'm asked if I want to get out of the Army 6 months early. And I said, yes, I'll do that. And so I coached with Dan Dougherty for that year. I was horrible. I did a crappy job. And I look back on that with great regret that I just wasn't ready to do it. I wasn't mature enough. And I was insecure. I just didn't get it. But he didn't hold it against me. And we became great friends after that. Ironically enough, I became a high school coach. And one of the coaches that I coached against at a rival high school was Dan Dougherty. So just crazy stuff. But before that, I'm just going to tell this quick story, and I hope it goes accordingly. So I was getting out of the Army. I was playing all sorts of sports and doing crazy stuff. I was on an Eastern League team but called the Cherry Hill Rookies. And the Cherry Hill Rookies 1 year and the Pros the next year, making $50 a game, sometimes getting paid, sometimes not. I coached a JV baseball team. One of my buddies got me to do that. And then my athletic director and the football coach at the local, at where I went to high school, Malvern Prep, came to me and said, hey, Malvern needs a new coach. And I said, yeah, it's great. I hope they get one. They said, we want you. I said, no, no. I got a pocket full of cash because I'm bartending every night and I'm playing golf every day. I'm having the time of my life. And they say, well, you need some direction. I said, no, I don't want any direction. I know exactly where I am. Well, finally, I relented and I became the high school basketball coach at Malvern Prep for 4 years. And then one of my teammates at LaSalle got the head coaching job at LaSalle. He brings me on as a part-time assistant coach. Then I go to American University because in the time I was a high school coach, I got a master's degree at Villanova. I felt like I wanted to get a doctoral degree. And one of the places that gave me an opportunity was American U, and Gary Williams was the head coach. So I coached with him for 2 years with a guy named Ed Tapscott for 3 years at American U, went back to LaSalle, coached with Lefty Irvin, who was my teammate for 1 year, Speedy Morris for 2 years, got the job at Penn as an assistant coach. The head coaching job was Tom Schneider, who had hired me. He left to go to Loyola Baltimore. I'm sitting there. I'm not the first. I'm not the second. I'm not the third choice. They finally give me the job. I just named a number of mentors in there, whether it be Gary Williams and Ed Tapscott and Lefty Irvin and Speedy Morris. But totally the guy that was most helpful would have been Dan Dougherty, just because he got me started in so many ways. And so that's the early years. And one of the things I would be remiss if I didn't say, and I'm going to say it now, that when you're young and you think you have all the answers, which when you get in a difficult situation, you quickly realize you don't have a damn clue as to what you're doing. But you're insecure and you think you've got to do everything. And at some point, you need to trust in your assistant coaches and you give them ownership. And I think that's a critical step. And then when you get very good at it, you can then trust in those kids that are playing you, a la Khalif Wyatt. And 4 minutes to go in the game, when they're coming off the court to listen to your gibberish at the 4 minute timeout, you say to them, what do you want to run? Because I could care less what we run. What I'm concerned about is how we run whatever we choose to do. So I might say to Khalif, where do you want that ball screen set? What do you want that screener to do? You want him to dive? You want him to screen away? You want him to pop? What is it that you want? But you're giving him ownership. And those a kid like Khalif Wyatt, at the end of his career, I trusted implicitly what he wanted to do because he was way smarter than me, had a great feel for the game. And he was good. He couldn't jump over this Saturday Daily News here in Philly, but he was so smart and so skilled. And his talent was unmistakable, but also his knowledge of the game was unmistakable too, because he was feeling it. And those are the guys that are doing the work out on the court. So you need at some point to reward them. You need to reward and give ownership to the coaches. You need to give reward and give ownership to the players as well. And then you take what comes along. It's everybody working together, and you hope that if you have some good players and good guys, that you're going to be okay. So I've made it through a number of years, and I'm very grateful for what we accomplished and the opportunities and the relationships that I built.
Oh, man. Doug, we're off to a running start, my friend. That was awesome.
I'm sure you met a ton of people, especially through that journey. Obviously, having the career you did, you definitely meet a lot of people, and that's the nice thing about it. I want to go back to one thing that you mentioned, and this kind of popped in my head as you were going. You were talking about like West Point and Army. What kind of valuable lessons did you learn from that? Because one of the best coaches that I have had has a military background, comes from a military family. He was very strict, but he was loose with it. Like he knew how to coach and use the military as a way to be able to keep people in line. Like, what kind of things did you learn from that to help you coach and keep your players in line?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Doug. I don't have something that jumps off the page of me right away, but when I think about it, there's a chain of command in the military that I think is critical. So one of the things I think you learn is as you're going through these things, and you might have something with a kid that is bothering you, that maybe he's missing some classes or that kind of thing. So what I always wanted to, my thought always was, I don't ever want to put the guys that I'm working for, whether it was my athletic director or when I was a head coach, again, the athletic director, but also the president of the institution, I don't want them to ever be surprised of anything that they might hear going on in our program. I want to tell them first, this kid's struggling academically. I don't know where we're going with this. I'm going to penalize them by making them go to study hall instead of coming to practice. That's one thing that we got used to doing was, if a guy, you know, was late coming to a study hall or late going to a class, I just say, you know what, don't bother coming to practice today. You go to study hall, do catch up, and I'll give your spot to the guy behind you. And you're going to do that? This is not hard. This is just doing the right thing all of the time. Go to class. Listen, you're talking to a guy that was a horrible student, but I had enough sense to go to class. And then we didn't have academic advisors in those days. And now the academic advisors are so valuable to you. We're going to give you as much help as we can. Take away all the excuses that you might have, and let's just stay on the same page. And if something's bugging you, then you come and tell me, and I'm going to say, I got it. I'll change it. Or I'm going to say, you're way off base. That's not how this works. It's not how life works. But let's work together on this deal. And I'll go back to Khalif Wyatt. And because I tell this, I don't know if he told the story, but I'm going to tell you the story that at the end of his freshman year, he was driving me crazy. He was a pain in the butt. And I said to him,
we talked about this.
He confessed this.
Yeah, your guys' rapport over the years got better.
Yeah. I said, do me a favor. Give me five schools that you want to transfer to. I'll drive you to every one of them. You and me, we're not going to make it together. We don't have that chemistry right now because you're thinking one way and I'm thinking totally the other. And he says, luckily he didn't listen to me because the next year is sophomore year. He didn't play much as a freshman. We had some really good players, by the way. He didn't play much as a freshman. And so he comes back and he becomes the sixth man of the year in the league. And then the last 2 years, he's the player of the year in the league. So luckily then he didn't hold it against me or anything else, but he was terrific to coach. And the ironic part is now he's in coaching. So yeah. Go figure all of that. But a brilliant basketball mind. He went on, I fired up about playing defense, by the way. But his offensive game was off the flipping charts. He sure was.
My God. Hey, comment on this, Coach. I heard Coach K say he did an interview with Shane Battier not too long ago, and the military question came up. Would you agree that, like, one of the things in the military is they, when you're especially going through training and some of the prep stuff, is like, they make sure you fail. And so then they teach you how to deal with failure. Because that's something right now, you could argue that in our society and especially in our game, there's a lot of side exits and trap doors that kids can run to when things get hard. And when you're training in the military, things are going to be hard because they're prepping you for hard. And so you, there is failure as a part of that process. Would you agree that that was a big part of that for you early? It's just learning how to fail.
I don't know that they teach, they set it up for you. The failure's going to come. It's just the way life works. And so then it's highlighted to the extent that it's talked about, and let's keep pushing and plugging away. And even from the physical side, there's physical testing that goes on, and you got to push yourself through a lot of stuff. And I can remember that these forced marches we'd be on, and guys, the group behind you, like, wanted to run right over you, and you got to figure out are you going to back out of the way and let those guys get in front of you? You're going to fight it a little bit. And so there's a lot of these things that I think are set up and planned. And I can remember there was a group of guys that in my company that said, let's get Sergeant whatever a present for Christmas. And I'm looking at that son of a gun. It's so hard on us. What the hell are we going to reward a present for, you know? But it's all getting along kind of thing. There's a reason why these guys like me and Khalif Wyatt were at odds, that we had to come together. And I was very willing to say, listen, I don't have all the answers, but I know one of them. You got to be on time, do this, do that. And sometimes we both got to keep our mouth shut and listen to what the other guy has to say. And so we finally learned that over time. And I think that's what the military teaches you. But you got to find your time where you can say what you want to say. It's not like blurting it out. That's not happening, because if we had 100 guys in the group and all 100 of us are trying to get something together, it ain't happening. That's not how life works. We all have a turn. We all have to earn your trust. And you have to do something that there's a guy ahead of you that says, I think Dumfries got a chance. He's a knucklehead, but I think he's got a chance. I'm seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. I think that aha moment that I think we all come to as coaches, as parents, as friends, I think my man is, I think he's getting it. He ain't there yet. He's getting it. And I think those are what we do this job for. The other part, I think we do it, but we're all competitors too. And the competition piece is so awesome. I loved every second of that. Now, the angst and the agita before the games was crazy for me. I don't know how you guys deal with it, but it was crazy for me. But when the ball goes up and the game starts, that all goes away, and you're just coaching your guys to be the. And then, if you win the game, you are at peace. And if you lose the game, the turmoil starts, and you can't get out of it until the next game comes. And you say to yourself, am I really doing this? Is this supposed to be fun? Well, and I don't know how you guys feel, but if you had an early game on a Saturday and you had no practice on Sunday and you win that early game, that Saturday night and all day Sunday, that peacefulness is what we live for.
No doubt.
Feeling of accomplishment, and your guys did a good job, and you feel, okay, I got a chance. I'm okay here.
Yeah.
And then Monday starts the angst, and Wednesday.
That's right. Then you take the rest of that Saturday watching everybody else beat the hell out of each other until it was time to, you kind of got yours out of the way.
I think the one big thing out of all of that too is just, I feel like being able to communicate with your players. There's times where maybe a coach does something wrong, or maybe it's the player, but like being able to have, to your point, that come to Jesus talk with them. Because I feel like if you can go up to your players, say you do something wrong, or maybe as a coach you overstep, or you yell at a kid and maybe you say something you should have, whatever it might be. I had a time where I cussed a kid out, and he was just being lackadaisical, walked over to him like a couple days later and said, hey, that was my bad. What I said wasn't appropriate. However, that being said, at the end of the day, I still love you, and I'm trying to get the best out of you, so I'm trying to push you. And I truly mean, when I said this to the kid, I've never seen the whole side of him turn, and he was like, wow, okay, so this guy really does care. So being able to have that open communication and like being able to relate to your players, I feel like it's such a huge thing as a coach, and that's something that's sometimes lost.
No, I would agree totally. I think when you get a little older and a little bit more secure with who you are, there's a kid that's screwing up a little bit, and instead of doing it outwardly through everybody, you might say, okay, hey, Joe, take Bob's spot, and you grab Joe and say, Joe, we can't be doing this. That's not how this is going to work. So let's come together on how we're going to make this next set work for us. But you don't do it openly. You do it quietly. And then the other part to this is and I think we all do this, at the end of a day, when your day is over, whatever it is, you've watched games, you've watched film, you lay there on the pillow and just say, okay, how did I do today? And much like you just said, Doug, I shouldn't have said what I said, or I shouldn't have said it the way I did, or the timing was crappy. And that happens to you on occasion. You have other days where everything went well and you say, I really feel good about how I handled that situation. Well, when you don't handle it well, you got to fix it the next day. You got to go to that guy and say, hey, I was a knucklehead yesterday and I apologize for it. You're still ticking me off, but I'm apologizing for it. But let's get on the same page, because you got a chance to really help us be a really good team. And that's what we're both trying to do here. And in the end, you're hoping that they spend 4 years with you, or 5 years, or today's world, it's 1 year.
I hope you get two.
But you're hoping that you're
they can finish the year.
Yeah, it's amazing. The world that we presently live in is really upside down. And I've said it many times. You can sit there and you can complain about it, or you can try to do something about it. And even if you don't have a wealth of monies to give to these kids, can you put together a group of 7, 8, 9 guys who are really dedicated to doing the job, and they may have a great year, and you're not going to have them the next year in a school like ours? We're going to get poached before we are the poacher, and just the way it is. And so you got to figure out a way who you are and what you're able to do, and you figure out how to put the best grouping of kids out on the court.
So I want to ask too about, I know you mentioned in the beginning, we spoke a little bit about this, but reverting back, like, you've had a tremendous amount of players and assistant coaches that have gone on. We've said his name already, but there's obviously a large tree and larger branch of, but Khalif Wyatt being one that was a player and then ended up being a coach. But just talk about, was there anything that you feel you did to best help your players and or assistants become head coaches someday? Because especially for you, like we said, you've had a large tree, you've had a large people come through, and a lot of successful coaches have developed underneath you. Was there anything that you feel you did during practices to allow your assistants, allow your players be vocal leaders and develop that quote unquote coaching voice?
I think once you get to the point of giving the ownership, that does as much as anything else help them be better. But I think how you go about your everyday life too, how you treat other people. So there was a stretch where we at Temple, we had over 50 managers in our program. It's a big public institution. I had plenty of friends, plenty of relatives, and they'll come to you and say, I got my nephew wants to be a manager. I'll send him in. So we would, and the guy who had the most difficult part was our operations guy who had to manage those managers.
That's right.
So it was easy for me to say, yeah, come on. Now you couldn't put them to work every single day, but there was a group of kids that worked Mondays and Thursdays, another group that worked Tuesdays and Fridays. But these are a bunch of young people, men and women, who wanted to get part of a group that was bigger than themselves. And how was I ever going to say no? And they are the salt of the earth. The salt of the earth are your managers and your walk-ons, who ask for absolutely nothing, because the other guys are conditioned to ask for everything and ask for a lot while they're asking for everything. And so you need these other people who just sacrifice for the group. But I think the bottom line on that is how you treat people, whether it's the people that are above you or the people below you, or the people to your left or your right. And that's what you do as a head coach. You manage up, you manage down, you manage to the left with alumni, fans, media, and you manage to the right with all the other folks, the faculty and people that you work every day. You got lots of managing to do, as you got lots of leading to do, but you got lots of managing to do too. And if you just take a step back, always make a decision that says, this is what's best for our program and what's best for life, then you'll be okay. You'll be okay. And hopefully you'll be successful.
Yeah. From a basketball perspective, Coach, like, briefly talk about what your philosophy, I know you're not coaching now, but you still have feelings about the game and what's important to you offensively, defensively. And then after that, share the importance of how, for young coaches, how important it is for them to develop their own philosophy. Because when you're a young coach, you're learning, you're pulling from this coach that you work for. You pull a little bit from this coach you work for. Eventually, you have enough ingredients to make your own stew. And it's important that you get to that point. But talk about just if somebody didn't know Fran Dunphy at all as a basketball coach, offensively, defensively, what were things that were important to you that you just felt were staples?
Yeah, I think a good question, Alan. I think the first thing is on the defensive end, if you got to be solid in the scoring area. I coached with Gary Williams for 2 years, and I couldn't do what he did because it didn't fit my personality. So let's say he would press after every play. And let's just say you take five possessions, and on two of them, you got a steal off the press, and two of the others, you got a quick shot that resulted in a missed shot. And so you've been successful right now every time. And then, but on that fifth time, they would get a breakaway dunk. Well, Gary Williams could handle the breakaway dunk. Fran Dunphy can't handle it. I don't want to get anything, anybody. Exactly. And knowing full well that I was going to be successful 80% of the time, I still couldn't get that done. So that, and I think you have to identify who you are and what your personality will allow. So I wanted to be best in the scoring area. And so, for example, I have a guy by the name of Joe Mihalik who helped me the last 3 years, and he would constantly say to me, let's play zone. And again, the same thing, you'd be successful like three of the four times you'd be successful. But that fourth time you'd give up a wide open three. And if you're not savvy enough, which I wasn't, all right, we're out of there. We're getting back to man.
That's right. Scrap it. That's yeah. Right.
Things of that nature. And then, but I think the basic tenor I would say is be solid as you can be in the scoring area and get everybody to buy into every exchange. Are we switching? What's our weak side defense like? Are we stepping over? Are we taking charges? Are we doing all that? Are we checking out properly? Be really good with that. And on the offensive end, I would always say to them, I'm going to give you freedom you give me everything you got it on defense. I'm going to give you freedom on offense. And I think that frees them up. But what you can have is just these poor decision-making plays, whether it's and you ask these kids to give up a good shot for a better shot. You ask them to move the basketball. You ask them to never turn it over. Don't make that risky pass there. Let's make sure that we get shots at the basket. And if you put that number on your offensive game of saying we need to have 10 or less turnovers, and that's going to make us the most efficient team. Things like that you build in. I think the last piece I would say to you on this is I was lucky enough to coach with some really good guys. And then the other part that you do, especially in today's world, where there's film of every single bounce at every single game, at every single practice, if you want to find it, everybody tapes that. So you borrow from others. I coached against Pete Carril, and I probably learned as much coaching against Pete Carril as I did anybody else, and just the way he would do things. And you'd sit there. I coached with a guy named Fran O'Hanlon who coached with me for 6 years. And I would, after practice, I'd say, why didn't I think of that? It's good, but he had a different mind than I had. And so it worked for us, but I certainly counted on him like crazy. And then again, you could, things on TV, you watch the pro game, you see a set, you say, let's throw it in there and throw it in the next day and see if it works. And that's what's great about head coaching. You can try anything you want. You got to be ready to pay the price for that, but you can try anything.
That's right.
But you learn from others. And again, you got to decide if you have an analytical mind that you can just see things differently. You see them at a different speed. You see them develop a pass or two before it. I wasn't that lucky. I didn't have that kind of a mind, a copying kind of mind rather than a creative, innovating kind of mind.
Yeah. Great stuff.
See, that's the unique thing is being able to understand what you're capable of as a coach. I feel like a lot of times people will go on, they'll watch somebody and they'll be like, oh, he does this. I want to do this. It's like, you have to be able to understand how to teach it. You have to want to understand about yourself. So like you understanding yourself and knowing what you were good at as a coach, obviously is easy for you to help relay to the players. But one thing I wanted to ask about, and I saw this, there was a quote from the Colgate head coach, Matt Langel, and that said that when you were recruiting him, I'm sure you probably see this or remember this. You said to him, when you come here, I'm not going to be your best friend. I am your coach. There are days when you won't agree with me or what we are doing, and you may not like me, but that's okay. Can you talk about this? Because I think that's a prime and great way to explain a head coach in a sentence, right? You're not always going to be their best friend. You're going to be the one who's screaming at them. But at the end of the day, they know they could treat you or look at you as like a father figure, essentially. Can you talk about that quote?
Yeah, I think I did say that. And I said it not only to Matt Langel, but many others. And I might expand it a little bit, saying that it's not necessarily that we're not going to be best friends while I'm coaching you. It might be during those 2.5 hours or 2 to 2.5 hours that we work together. Off the court, I'm going to be different. But on the court, once we get between 94 by 50, we're not doing anything else other than worrying about our basketball. I can't worry about what you're doing. So when your class time troubles hit, let's deal with them outside of class. I don't want them lingering during the practices that we have or their personal relationships, or if your family's not doing so well, let's talk about it. Let's try to find the solution to it, but not during the 94 by 50 when we're in our classroom situation. That we got to be dedicated to the cause here. And then at the end of their careers, you're going to their weddings and you're watching how they grow their families and all of those things. That's a natural reaction of parenting, of mentoring, of doing whatever it is that we do in the coaching world, that you're rooting like crazy for these guys. And I'd be honest with you, I've had probably too many guys go into coaching. What are you doing? It's a crazy profession.
You're trying to talk them out of it.
Yeah, right. One of these guys are really talented. They can do unbelievable things. The other part to that we're getting away from in these days, those guys that you sit and the girls that you sit beside and behind and in front of in class, they're get to know them, and because they're going to be successful people. And the other part to this is when you have a really good team, those guys stay together forever. There's nothing like that. I would always put on there's a great old hockey coach here in Philadelphia by the name of Fred Shiro. And Fred wrote in the locker room on the board before their 7th game of a Stanley Cup playoff, "Win today and we walk together forever." And that's what happens when you're on a really good team. Those guys, they stay together. They're in touch all the time. They're coming back to see you. And on the other years where you don't have such a good team, they don't stay as together. And is it a chicken and the egg kind of thing? Those together guys win, the not together guys don't. What is it that makes it? It's a combination of a lot of things. And there's probably some years where you did a really good job of coaching and you kept everybody together. And there was probably some years where you did a really crappy job of coaching and we didn't stay together. Or you sit back and at the end of the day, you said, you know what? I didn't do a good job with my team today. I just didn't. I got to fix it tomorrow somehow, some way, because we got a big game coming up.
If you were meeting with a group of young coaches and one of them said, "Coach, how would you define leadership?" I heard a great quote recently, is that people can't be what they can't see. Mm-hmm. And how would you describe what leadership looks like and what that means to you, to a group of young coaches that are just trying to get a grip on what that means?
Yeah, I think it might go back to how you treat people every single day and not the people that you're coaching always. It's that when, for example, we have a Coaches Versus Cancer program in Philly, and we have a place called the Hope Lodge right outside of Philly. And it's a place where it's a Ronald McDonald House for adults. They're coming to Philly for their cancer treatments, and this Hope Lodge gives you a room, and it's just, they take care of you. It's all free of charge. It's money that we raise in our Coaches Versus Cancer program. And they take you back and forth to your treatments. They feed you. They do all of this stuff. One year, I took my Temple team up there. And so we were feeding the patients. So I grabbed 2 plates and I go over to a table where there's a couple from Northeast Pennsylvania. And they're in here. They're getting breast cancer treatments for the wife. And I sit down and I start a conversation. I turn around and every kid on the team is grabbing 2 plates, sitting down with 2 other people. They have no idea who they are, but they're sitting there and they're providing the meals and they're engaging in conversation. And I will tell you immediately, when I was their age, there's no flipping way. I just wasn't prepared to do that kind of thing. These kids are different today. They're knuckleheads sometimes, because we all are, but they can do that kind of thing and they can engage better than I ever could. It was my leadership that says this is okay to do, Now, it took me a lot longer to learn it than it's going to take them. But it's those simple things that you do. And there, I have a guy that I sit with it for 3 years. I sat with him at Temple Games when I was there. And we'd sit way up top and people would say to me, why do you sit up there with him? Because he's worth my time. And it means a lot to him. There's a lot of other people that could care less about sitting with me, but he thinks it's cool to sit with me. And he's a guy that has shown me great love and concern and care. And that's what we do. We sit up there and I eat a box of popcorn and drink a Diet Coke. And I love watching the games from that vantage point. And then when I got the job at LaSalle, he comes to every game. He thinks he's supposed to come. And that's all that matters to me. He's my friend. And so how you treat other people, and it doesn't have to be the people above you. I think it needs to be more often the people below you that can never repay you for any kindness that you show to them. So it's really important that maybe if you're the first guy, we're busing a 3.5-hour, 4-hour trip and we get to your destination. We'll jump off the bus and start unloading the bags on the bottom so that the managers aren't there. And you're helping the managers, you're opening a door, or you're doing whatever you do. Do something that's real simple and important, and then everybody will start to give. So that leadership piece, I think, is critical. But we can learn it in so many different ways.
That's contagious. Good. That's so good, man.
It's completely contagious. I tell our upperclassmen all the time, our seniors, like, you don't understand. The freshmen are watching your every step, and they'll never say it. They'll never act it. You'll never even really know it as a senior. But the freshmen and the younger guys and everybody are watching every step you take. And even the coaches, they're watching every step you take. I'm glad you said that, because that's something huge. A ton of people out there can learn that you have to ultimately be the role model subconsciously and do the right things, and everybody else will follow. But before we get to the closing remarks and the final things to throw in, Coach, I just wanted to throw in a final question for you that we always like to ask everybody. And really, if we bring you back to your first coaching days, right? Kind of might have to think back a little bit here, but knowing what you know now, is there any advice that you would share with your younger self in your first coaching position? And what would that advice be?
There's great leadership and power in being vulnerable. And again, when you are insecure, you think you can't show vulnerability. You can't cry at something that makes you sad or makes you happy even. Both are okay reasons to cry. But you need to show that you are fallible. You don't have all the answers. But when you're young and you're, again, insecure, you think that's a sign of weakness. The reality is a little later on in your life, you're going to see it as a sign of strength. But and it's not, you don't want to do it at every turn, but you have to show that vulnerability somehow, some way. I'm sorry that this happened. Like even you going to that kid, Doug, and said, I screwed up here. I was wrong. You have to show that vulnerability. That means that you are stronger, that you are a good leader. You're fallible. You're quite capable of making my own mistakes. I don't need anybody to help me do that. I'm a knucklehead here. But I'm going to try to, but most importantly, once I make that mistake, I got to try to fix it. And hopefully you'll give me that opportunity to fix it and you won't hold it against me. But you have to show those people that you're working with every day that it's okay to be giving me some advice. I may take it and use it. I might cast it aside and we can talk about it if you want, but it's something that I think we have to share with each other. And once you do that, I think you become a better leader. And it's not that the most vocal guy leads. I say it to my guys all the time. And leadership wears many different costumes. It could be at the end of a practice where you're shooting fouls. And we do a thing where, you know, if you got to make two guys got to make one-on-ones in order not to run. And it's not a lot of running. It's up and back, one thing. But it's that kind of thing. And what we also do is if you miss the shot, then we don't allow you to run. Your teammates have to run. So you stand there. Sometimes we even had an easy chair that was at half court. You sit there while your teammates run. You do encouraging, in my way of thinking, encouraging things that you really feel crappy after it. And then that same guy's at the end of it, then you need an extra foul shooter. They're saying, okay, I'll shoot this foul. because I'm going to make up for my mistake. That's what you want. That's what you want to see. So it's that kind of thing that we all do. And again, even the leadership might take place where the fastest guy says, I'm winning every time. I'm not. And so you say, why don't you? And then there's that time where he doesn't win and you say, why not? Just because you didn't want to push yourself that hard. And again, some days you're just not there, but let's not make it too many days because we need you. And that's always the message. And these guys need you. They want that leadership from you. And you show that leadership by winning the sprint, by making the foul shot, or by encouraging your teammate. If you don't, that's, I think, really helps us immeasurably.
Coach, again, hang out with us a little bit when we sign off. But I personally just want to say, number one, thanks for your friendship. Your teams are hard as hell to coach against. I took my share of ass whippings from you. But more importantly, again, just appreciate you as a friend. It's been a long time since we connected. So just this selfishly, it's just been great to hang out with you again because it's been a long time. And thank you so much for doing this because our whole goal with this Rising Coaches podcast is how can we, it's not about helping individual coaches rise and get a better spot. This is about raising the profession. So whoever listens to us, whether they're youth leaguers or G leaguers or Euro leaguers, whoever's listening, what can we do, me and Doug, to try to make this profession better? And everybody we bring on, that's, we want to make sure the people that we bring on are going to help our game grow and help people grow. And so we got better today because of you. So this has been awesome, man.
I appreciate it, Alan. Good to be with both of you guys. I will say something to Doug here. You gave me my fish today, but you didn't teach me to fish. I had no chance of doing what you just did on that, getting this thing together, but that was pretty cool.
Hey, that's what we're here. I'm learning to be a coach, and I'm coaching. Right? It all comes back around.
Leadership wears many costumes. Yeah.
I had no way, no understanding of the double click on the bottom right of my computer. Add here, and so it's
the right click.
Yeah, it amazes me.
Yes, sir. I can teach you more about the computer.
You learn it in school, for crying out loud. That never happened to me in my high school days, and it amazes me how you guys of the younger generation just have this feel for these computers. That, you know, obviously I didn't grow up with it, but I feel like a real dunce when I'm.
No, trust me. I'm there too. That's why it's reciprocal, but it's something that just takes trial and error. I want to make sure to give a quick shout out for everybody on here. We have just a quick collab. We have Rising Coaches Conference out in California, July 22nd. We are collabing with US Nike Basketball Camps and Snow Valley Camps. Anybody interested, feel free to check in on our website, risingcoaches.com, as well as our social medias. You can sign up and make sure to get there. It's a coaches convention. A lot of people will be there, so we want to make sure to tune in. And everybody, that does it. Coach Dunphy, thank you. Another episode of the Rising Coaches Podcasts. As again, Alan and Doug here, your hosts. Keep working and keep rising, coaches.
Dr. Dish Basketball is revolutionizing basketball training with the number one selling shooting machine in the world. Our innovative systems are the only training solutions that deliver more reps, motivation, and fun, empowering coaches and players to elevate their game faster than ever before. Featuring advanced analytics, immersive game-like features, and an easy-to-use interface, our state-of-the-art shooting machines are the preferred choice for progressive teams worldwide.
I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in with us this episode. If you are not a member, want more content, or even be a potential member on our member spotlight to have your story heard, go visit risingcoaches.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Rising Coaches. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating, and review so we can continue to keep rising together.